Will Brexit boost jobs or wreck the NHS or cause food shortages? From strawberries to passport, Gavin Esler sets out the most momentous change for Britain for decades and how it's going to change everyday life. In seven succinct chapters, he reveals how leaving the European Union will affect us all. The book is called Brexit Without the Bullshit. Delighted to be joining me live on the line, journalist, television presenter, and who stood for Change UK in the London region, Gavin Esler. Gavin, good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
It's very good to have you with us on the show on this day of all days. Just such a shame that nothing has happened in the past 24 hours to bring Brexit into the public eye once again.
Yes, well, I think we are... one of the reasons I wrote the book was to try to find out the facts about Brexit. But the overriding reason was that things are bigger than Brexit going on. And those two things that strike me are, one, the normalization of lying in public life. I spent 1 year on one lie, which was when I was in America. It was, the lie was, I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky, which was almost brought down the Clinton administration. But now, both in the United States and also, unfortunately, in Britain, it seems that politicians can say almost anything which is factually incorrect and get away with it. And so I wanted to find as much as possible about the facts about what Brexit would actually look like, not the false promises, not the silly statements, but what will it do, for example, our food suppliers or pharmaceutical suppliers? What will it do to those British people who live in the EU now? And if their healthcare is no longer reciprocated by whichever their host nation, whether it's Spain or anywhere else. So that's what I looked at. And I have to say, when I talked I talked to the publisher, my working title was Brexit Without the Bullshit. But I worried that if I took away all the bull, if there was anything left at all, or if it would be a fairly blank book. But I'm afraid I found quite a lot of stuff that I found very concerning. There are some minor upsides to what we now face, but they are so minor, I think they are drowned out by the downsides.
But you could, I mean, you could say that interesting point you make about the fact that you're in a 24/7 world where we're being fed information, not just from, if you like, traditional newspapers, newsprint, the television, radio, but the advent of social media, everybody on Facebook, everybody on Instagram, that sort of thing, means that now journalists are being bombarded by so much information that we have to be our own editor. And the one side of the coin is saying Brexit is going to do is, you know, the sunny uplands, and you were indulging in Project Fear.
Yes, I mean, this is what we have been told for 3 years now. But, of course, every time people point out the holes in the argument for Brexit, they change the argument. So you will remember it was sunlit uplands and trade deals, the easiest trade deals in history, and we hold all the cards and have our cake and eat it, which very slowly morphed into, how about Norway plus and Canada plus plus? There was always a plus there, you know, as if I often wondered, what was this plus? You know, you'll have Brexit, but you'll also then get a cappuccino brought to you every morning. I mean, it was just all fantasy land. And unfortunately, what happens with populist statements, both sides of the Atlantic, Donald Trump, I'm going to build a wall, our dear Prime Minister now in Britain, Boris Johnson, talking about building garden bridges, building a bridge from France to England, building a bridge from Scotland to Ireland. I mean, these are just nonsense words. And the trouble is, when the facts show the promises are hollow, then people begin to lose faith, and populists tend not to be able to deliver. So we still await the wall in the United States that Mexico is going to pay for. We still await the nuclear deal with North Korea that we were told that the president had. And when you see that the falsehood on these really big issues is so prominent, it is you do wonder how these people can stay in power. And Mr. Johnson this week has really gone for broke. I mean, he has really pushed things beyond Brexit into a constitutional crisis. And this is going to be the biggest defining moment for Britain since the 1930s.
The The thing with populist policies, though, and politicians, is the fact that when the edifice starts to be chipped away, you can argue, they move the goalposts. So for 1 minute, it's, oh, we've got migrants coming in on boats across the channel, so that's going to be the big thing. And then it's going to be, oh, the EU aren't split, it's the EU and the undemocratic backstop. And now, in the past 24 hours, as you said, you know, Prime Minister Johnson has basically plunged the UK into, as you said, the biggest constitutional crisis for 30 years. I remember speaking to the British ambassador to Spain, Simon Manley. He said the whole Brexit thing was the biggest democratic issue in 150 years. This surely is the ultimate bit of populist politician posturing.
Well, the question really is, I think this, that Boris Johnson was elected by roughly less than 100,000 people who are members of the Conservative Party. And we've not had a chance to vote whether we want him as our Prime Minister or not. And we may get that soon. But this bit of political chicanery going on at the moment and constantly talking about the will of the people, unfortunately, has echoes in the 1930s in Europe rather than in Britain. And the will of the people... the people did not speak with one will. A slight majority voted in favour of leaving. But we now think, the most recent polling suggests, that if there were a second referendum, that would change and would be reversed. And the will of the people changes. We all change our minds about things, especially when we know what the facts are. And the facts are quite grim. They're quite grim for any kind of version of Brexit will make us poorer. Any version that is on the table. And some people are prepared to accept that and others are not. But the prospect of a no-deal Brexit would mean that we wouldn't, far from holding all the cards, we'd be handing the pack to other people. If the Prime Minister is serious about crashing out by November the 1st, then on November the 1st, we will have to figure out what is going to be our relationship with our most important trading partners. If we're really going to keep back the $39 billion that has been suggested that we won't pay, well, I'm afraid... I would have thought that the EU27 would make number one condition for opening talks about trade being, please give us the money that you owe us. So it's a very fraught situation, and relying on the goodwill of Donald Trump to strike a trade deal is preposterous, not just because Mr. Trump will say anything at any moment, but mostly because he doesn't actually make the trade deal. The trade deal will go to Congress and will be carved up. And already the Democrats in Congress have made it absolutely clear that unless the Northern Ireland backstop remains, they will not pass a trade deal. So I don't know where we're going if we do crash out. And I think everything is to play for still in the next week or two in the House of Parliament. And you could imagine that key people now are going to be the moderate Conservative MPs who are shocked by what Boris Johnson has done. And they may, I think it was very difficult for them to fall into line behind Jeremy Corbyn and put him in as Prime Minister, but they will be looking for alternative solutions because they don't like what they see. They don't like what's happened to the Conservative Party, which is no longer conservative. I mean, it's the most radical revolutionary step in politics of my lifetime, from a party which is based on the idea that you make slow progress towards making things better for people. So we're really in a crisis now.
The thing is, I mean, I was listening to the BBC World Service last night and they had some vox pops with members of the public from Stratford-upon-Avon, and a lot of people were saying, well, and we call them Bobs, Board of Brexit. Oh, well, they, the politicians, have been trying to do it for 3 years now and they haven't got it sorted out. So it's somebody like, and I hate the way when they use Boris as if he's sort of a cuddly cartoon character, but, you know, Boris will sort it out and we'll just crash out of Europe, you know, crash out of Europe without any sort of thought about what that entails.
Well, I always am very wary of people in the street being asked quite complicated questions to give answers in 10 seconds. But I know exactly the kind of opinions you've heard. The one big thing I would say is that it is absolutely clear that Brexit is not an event. It's a process. So if we do crash out on October 31st, we will have 5 to 10 years of discussing Brexit on top of what we've already done. Because Brexit will not stop. It will begin on November the 1st. And that is the key problem here. When people say, just get on with it, first of all, we haven't agreed what it is among ourselves. Secondly, nobody voted for it to be a no-deal Brexit. That was never on the table. thirdly, it will not be over by November the 1st. It will begin on November the 1st, and that's when the real problems begin. And things like pharmaceutical supplies, I mean, just two quick examples from the book. Insulin is all imported into Britain. If you are diabetic, and unfortunately a very large number of people are, in our country, type 1 or type 2 diabetes, the question is, will you get your medicine? And secondly, and this is slightly more comedic, but it's still true, all the Viagra imported into the all the Viagra that's used in the United Kingdom is imported from Ringaskiddy in County Cork. That's where it's made. Now, gentlemen, you may like to think about this.
So not are we isolated, but we're impotent as well, then, are we?
Well, that may be one of the consequences of Brexit. And there are other more, serious things as well. Simple facts, like, I didn't know this until I began researching the book, because like everybody who voted in 2016, nobody had told us what Brexit would look like. So when I started to ask around about our food production, and the most interesting thing about that is that 95% of the vets in slaughterhouses in Britain are EU 27 nationals. They're not British. 95%. Now, if some of them, even because the pound has gone down, choose to go back to their original country, or others choose to leave, we will have, obviously, problems in our slaughterhouses, certifying that animals are fit for slaughter. And then there's also the casual workers who come in, the ones who pick our crops, what will happen to certain things in the field. Now, people will say this, some people will say, oh, this is just project fear. I'm just laying out the facts as they are. And whether people feel less welcome or the fact that the pound keeps dropping means that I know of one case, for example, a builder I know had half a dozen Polish workers who all went home last Christmas and haven't come back to London because they can make more money elsewhere because the pound's gone down. So there's all kinds of knock-on consequences, including those for resident British people who are resident in EU 27 countries.
This is one of the things, because obviously, I mean, 300,000 registered Brits, they reckon in Spain, that could be as high as 750,000, really, if you look at the real figures. A lot of people like myself have been living in Spain for over 15 years. We were disenfranchised. We were not allowed to vote. And one of the things, I was back in the UK 2 weeks ago, and a lot of the people over there have no idea what that means for us. And people are saying, oh, well, you can just get your new paper. You can just sign a stamp. You know, you were here in the 70s. It was like that. The key word here is reciprocal, because... Yeah. If the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, decides that you've got to make £36,000 to stay in the UK, there's nothing to stop Moncloa, the Spanish government, saying, OK, well, same here.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I talked to a Spanish journalist about this as part of the research in the book, and he made exactly the same point, which is whatever, and he is somebody who's resident in Britain and very pro-British, but he made the point that if we in this country create effectively a hostile environment for people from other countries who settled here, particularly the EU 27 countries who come here under freedom of movement, what would stop other countries doing exactly the same? And reciprocity is part of it. And in terms of healthcare, I mean, many people, I've got the European health card that I use if, unfortunately, I fall sick in somewhere in the EU, but that will go. And the question of the healthcare that people resident in Spain can expect in the future, who happen to be British citizens, I think is obviously in doubt. And one of the things that the health experts, think tanks, have done is calculate what would happen, say, if half the British people resident in Spain decided that as they grow older, their healthcare is going to be too expensive in Spain, they'd have to come back to the United Kingdom. What would be the impact on the NHS? And it would be very, very considerable. So all these things are, some of the things in the book are from private conversations with people who wanted to talk to me on background. But most of this is openly available. It's open source stuff done by people who are real experts. And that is what's so worrying. It's all there. But nobody in the government, the current government, sought to tell us some of the facts about reciprocity and other things.
But perhaps that is this highlights the current state of politics where we are in the UK, where it's politics of soundbite, of the 30-second stab, and then move on quickly before anybody, you know, you say you spoke to experts. Well, you know, last year, experts were being ridiculed and it was the will of the people. So let's get rid of the experts and let's just listen to what the people say.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's why I said when people go out on the street and they ask for vox pops about what do you think of Brexit, you know, they're going to get an answer that is not actually particularly well informed because people have not been informed about this. And in terms of experts, I mean, one of the most obvious things is that a trade deal has to be negotiated by people who know what they're doing. And trade deals are very complicated. They take years and years to work out. So just to organize a trade deal with the United States, for example, I have I've listened into the U.S. Trade Representative's hearings. The U.S. Trade Representative is the person who will negotiate a trade deal. And what they've been doing in the United States is inviting in anybody who thinks they would like to trade with Britain to tell them how to negotiate. And the pork producers of America, which represent 60,000 different pig farms and pork producers and so on, in 42 different states, so they're politically very powerful, because if you're in 42 different states, there's 42 sets of senators, 84 senators, who will listen to you. And what the pork producers say is Britain is going to have to take American pork. And American pork is banned in the EU and also Russia and China and more than 100 other countries because they feed their pigs something called ractopamine, which is pretty bad for the pigs, and we think it's disgusting, so we don't have it. So there's a whole series of things in which American producers who have real political leverage are saying to the American trade representative, you've got to get this from the British. Now, we could get a quick trade deal if we agree to everything they say, but it would not be in our best interest. So those things are really complicated and demand experts to negotiate them. But of course, the British government pretends they're very simple, and Donald Trump, of course, says, yeah, guys, of course you're going to get a great deal from us. Well, as we know, Mr. Trump's view of a great deal is America first. Now, that means not Britain first, obviously.
When you went through the research of this book, Gavin, was it somewhat like finding a particularly sort of past its sell-by-date onion? I mean, basically, the more layers you pulled off, the sort of the more mushy and the more horrible it got towards the centre.
Well, I have to say, I was shocked by some of this, and I was shocked by stuff I can barely even pronounce it, but I'll try. For instance, if you have cancer in Britain, or people think you've got cancer, doctors think you've got cancer, they use something called technetium 99,
right?
A radioactive isotope, which is made from something called molybdenum 99, which is all imported and has a very short half life. In other words, if it gets stuck in a port for a few days, it's useless. Now, it is possible, I suppose, there could be emergency flights for that and emergency flights for insulin and emergency flights for all sorts of stuff, but it's a bit unlikely. And so we are so interconnected. And to go back to something you said at the start of our conversation, everything from migration, migrants coming across the English Channel, or people coming into Spain, for example, migration, climate change, disease, cancer, poverty, these tend to be international problems. And the idea that any of them have got nationalist solutions is just nonsense. I chaired the European Cancer Conference just before Christmas, and this was doctors, medical practitioners of various types from all over the EU getting together to say, how can we make things better? What can we learn from Denmark or Germany or Spain or whatever, or Britain, in terms of cancer care and treatment and survival and the psychological effects of surviving cancer, which are quite profound now. And fortunately, so many of us will get cancer, but more of us are surviving. And so what are the effects? Now, we can learn from this interchange of ideas, and we can learn from the interchange between universities. But this is becoming much more difficult because of even the idea of Brexit. It's already become more difficult. For instance, I know of one university colleague in a university in London who said to me that she she has been told by a prominent European university, don't make any plans for any joint research between us for the next year or two, because the bureaucracy will be so complicated, and we don't know what the British government's attitude is. And we don't want, our students are very unlikely to come to Britain to study because they want to plan 3 years ahead for their PhD, for example. And you can't do that given the current state of the British government. So all these things are already happening, even though Brexit itself hasn't.
That perhaps is the biggest tragedy of this, because I came to Spain when I was 17. I went to an international school. There were 300 pupils and 32 different nationalities, and it sort of shaped my education. And I grew up with the single Europe of Jacques Delors. I grew up as a European. And for this to be taken away overnight, and for subsequent generations not to have the opportunities to travel, work, and experience life in Europe, I think is perhaps the greatest tragedy, ideological tragedy, of the whole Brexit deal.
Well, one of the other things, and again, this is entirely on the public record, is that if Britain comes out of the European Union, we will need visa waivers to travel in the European Union, which is just bizarre. And I happen to know, I'm one of those people who's lucky enough to manage to get to Spain at least once a year. And when I went to my local post office to ask if Brexit happens, will my driving license be valid? Of course, you can go on the British government websites about things like this, but they're very confusing, particularly about pets, taking pets to Europe. But in terms of the driving license, my very friendly post office lady looked at me and she said, if you're going to the EU 27 countries, we're advised that you should have an international driving permit. I said, okay, give me one. She said, ah, that's the catch. If you're going to most of the EU, France, for example, you need one version which lasts for 3 years. But if you're going to Spain, Malta, and Cyprus, you need another version which only lasts 1 year. Where are you going?
Yes.
Now, there we are. I've got two of them, and they look like, I don't know what a ration book from World War II looks like, but they're bits of paper that have obviously been lying in some government warehouse for years.
Yes.
We never needed them.
I remember them from the early 80s. They've probably just given them a dust down and gone with it. When you press the send button on Brexit without the bullshit, Gavin, what's your feeling for it? I mean, you know, you were at the helm for Newsnight for a very long period of time, and you stood as a change UK. What's your gut feeling on this one?
Well, I think my gut feeling is that the British people are very slow to anger, and we have all been badly misinformed by the government. But I do think that there's still all to play for. My personal view, and I hope, is that Boris Johnson has completely overreached himself. That he is really acting as if he is a dictator, frankly, in telling us that this will happen, that Parliament, I mean, the whole point of taking back control, we were told, given that we have the sovereignty of Parliament, was for Parliament to have control. And now he's saying, well, we don't think Parliament needs to meet. We don't want to bother their pretty little heads with all these discussions about Brexit. And he's pretending it's about his exciting, wonderful agenda going forward. And unfortunately, I think most people recognize that the Prime Minister, who has a track record of lying about other things, was fired by the Times for making up quotes, was fired by Michael Howard for lying about his private life, and has had a long track record of telling lies. I think, unfortunately, he is lying again. Now, whether this is sufficient to bring together the MPs from all other parties, including some Tory MPs who I know are very worried, I've talked to a couple of them, who are very, very worried by this, and to unite in a vote of no confidence in him, and whether he will do what prime ministers are supposed to do if there's a vote of no confidence and resign, that's all up for grabs. But I think that this is a crucial moment for our country, and it is one that historians will pore over for years to come. And Mr. Johnson is playing for the highest stakes, and they're much higher than Brexit. It is actually the future of our democracy, whether we are a parliamentary democracy and whether we listen to the will of Parliament, which is, you know, the will of the people is something that in 1933 we heard a lot of from Germany. But we don't talk about the will of the people in Britain. We talk about the will of Parliament, because that's why we have a parliamentary system. And all of that is now threatened, unfortunately. I remain, as I've been for months, optimistic that in the end we might win this, but who knows?
The book is called Brexit Without the Bullshit, and we said that before 12 o'clock. It's by Gavin Essler. Gavin, if people want to find out more about you or by the book, whereabouts are you on the social media and the media?
Yes, I'm on Twitter at Gavin Essler, and that's the best way to find out more. And I will be, I suspect, tweeting quite a bit in the days to come. And I'm also, I hope, coming to the Gibraltar Book Festival. So if anybody is in south of Spain and fancies coming along, I think it's towards the middle or end of November.
Look forward to that if we can get across the border, of course, by that point. Gavin Essler, Brexit Without the Bullshit, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Bye.